Totally Football Show. It's been another box office weekend. From Crazy Pitch Invasions to Baggy's decision to Roger Moore, we've got a lot to talk about. We relive the highlights like Shaka Swiss Waz and the lowlights like Jack Grealish's Brum Plum and all of the big stories as we count down to another big midweek in the Champions League. All that and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Jimbo's at the wheel and reclining in our luxuriously upholstered interior today. We have Tom Williams.
Good morning, James.
Speaking that football, mixing up Michael Cox.
Hi, James.
Big week of European football, of course. And thank goodness, therefore, that James Horncastle's here.
Hi, James.
Have you had a good weekend, James?
Spectacular.
Yeah, Paul McIntosh is feeling chipper. He says, is this one of the best Premier League seasons in years? We've got a title race, a seriously tight battle for third and fourth, at least half a dozen teams in the relegation fight, and even a decent scrap for seventh. I was at St James's Park on Saturday, and to be honest, isn't everything brilliant? Wow, it was a remarkable game, that one at St James's Park, one we'll be coming to later on. So many things that Paul mentions there. Where do you want to start?
At the top.
At the top.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Still just a 1 point between Man City and Liverpool, both of whom have Bundesliga opposition coming up Tuesday and Wednesday. Staring at the entrails of City's match and Liverpool's, what emerges, do you think?
That we clearly need VAR.
Because of the Raheem Sterling opener against Watford.
Well, and also Burnley's opener against against Liverpool as
Fair.
Well. You know. So, you know, maybe that's why it's one of the best Premier League seasons in memory, because next year we'll have VAR to ruin it all.
So, Watford had frustrated City for 45 minutes, and then as soon as the second half opens, that bizarre decision to allow that goal. What was the basis of it? That it had been touched by a defender, or what?
Yeah, I think that the defender was in control of his touch and had deliberately played it, but... You know, to go back to the debate we had last week, I think he's challenging for the ball. I think he and Sterling are in a challenge for the ball. And Jan Mat's only making that tackle or challenge or clearance because Sterling's there. I can't see how that can be offside, either kind of morally in terms of what we think the offside rule should be, or even according to the current regulations. I just think that's clearly offside.
Well, Sterling, in the course of minutes, then went on to make it 3-0, kind of shifting the story across to what an incredible season he's having.
Yeah, he did really well. And I think the three goals show different ways he's become such a good goal scorer. One, you know, the final goal was a fantastic finish, a dink over the goalkeeper. The second one was the goal he scored a lot, which is basically an open goal after someone's done the hard work and squared it across the six-yard box. And even the first, he has scored quite a lot of lucky goals, I would say, over the last... Well, since the start of last season, there was one at Bournemouth that took a strange deflection. There was another one that hit him and looped into the net. And I guess that comes just from getting in the right positions.
Don't tell Pep they're lucky goals. Pep's not having any of that luck business, as you probably saw post-match. But what about from Watford's point of view, having done such a sterling job in that first half, had that goal not gone in, could you see them maybe hanging on and then throwing De Olofeo and Deeney on late and maybe snatching something?
Well, you know, De Olofeo did come on and score with his first touch, by which point the game was over. I think the thing with City is the way they dominate matches, even had they not scored from that Sterling chance, chances are they're going to score at some point. I mean, it clearly leaves a sour taste for Watford, knowing that they'd held out until then without conceding, and then to concede a goal in those circumstances. But I think the way that City just sort of asphyxiate their opponents, I kind of feel like that breakthrough was probably on its way at some point.
I mean, Javi Gracia did say that that goal, the first one, did change the game completely, because Watford felt a sense of injustice, and within 30 minutes, the game was gone. You know, they never recovered from it. And yeah, I think one of the talking points as the teams came out was that Watford had made, what, 7 changes for that game. Some Liverpool fans' sort of eyebrows raised about that. And yet it was because he's got a full squad of players, 26 players who are all fit and healthy. He realised that he needed a really kind of high-energy performance because, as Tom says, City at home this season, you're not going to have the ball. You're going to have to do a lot of running. They stayed in the game all that time. And, yeah, I do have some sympathy for them that ultimately, yeah, they shouldn't have been behind. and you know, never were able to kind of get that out of their minds. And yeah, I think that really did have a big impact on the game.
Fair enough then. Sunday then, Liverpool-Burnley, which started badly. First of all, it was windy. Then there was Lallana on the team sheet, which provoked an explosion of Neymar-looking distressed memes from Liverpool fans. And then Burnley took the lead, direct from Westwood's corner.
I wrote an article last week for ESPN about potential law changes, and one law change I think should happen is I think attackers should be banned from being in the six-yard box when attacking corners.
Attackers as in the attacking team?
The attacking team.
Okay.
Because it doesn't happen so much in the Premier League, aside from kind of lower league teams like Burnley who are in the Premier League, if that makes sense. But you do get a lot of... In the lower leagues, you do just get a lot of... goalkeepers being crowded by three men and then just corners whipped in onto the top of the head, and I don't think that's what football is. I don't think it should be. I don't think you should be able to score goals like that. I think this situation actually was a foul. I think it should have been given as a foul, but sometimes you have attackers just standing there going, I'm not fouling the goalkeeper, I'm not doing anything. But they're only there to compromise the goalkeeper's position.
Well, the old Big Sam routine from Blackburn, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's always teams. It's always the same kind of teams who do it. So I think this was a foul, and I also don't really like
Tarkowski,
that kind of goal.
Wasn't it? No, clamouring all over.
Well, yeah, and also Cork was Alisson in front of him. So, like, just even if Alisson was going to jump and kind of claim the cross, he had to get over Cork first, but then was being held down by Tarkowski. So, I mean, it was kind of... He was being doubly obstructed there, really. So,
and it's a pity because a goal being scored direct from a corner is a really exciting thing. A goal Olympico, a real rarity. But then as soon as you saw the replays, it was like, ah, that was a blatant foul on the goalkeeper. Yeah. So
it all worked out in the end for Liverpool, and particularly the Lallana element, is who had been regarded as one of Klopp's worst decisions when he was brought on as a sub in the previous match in the derby. But here... His creativity in midfield and his work rate, was that one of the keys to Liverpool's win?
Yeah, I think he played really well. I mean, he was given man of the match by Sky. He's always been a good player, Lallana. He had some really bad injury problems, and I think his problem has been the kind of secondary to that in the sense that he's never really got back up to full fitness because he hasn't had the matches, and when he's come on, he's looked rusty. But, I mean, he's exactly what Liverpool have been crying out for in some of these games, someone who can connect midfield and attack. And he's also... always been kind of up to speed with the pressing. Obviously, he played under Pochettino at Southampton, I think was geared towards that mindset. And we saw that for the Mane goal here. The goal came from basically a blocked tackle on the edge of the opposition box. So, yeah, I think he fits into the system and gives them something different, which is
great.
Exactly.
Because Bardsley just doesn't even see it coming. Like, I mean, I think Lallana comes sort of out of the box and then comes across, and it's a great sort of sliding counter-pressing move, which Klopp was very keen to sort of point out afterwards. But yeah, I think a very positive afternoon for Liverpool. Come back from behind. They obviously had a lot of time to do that because Burnley went ahead early. But to see the front three, a little bit like the Watford game where Salah doesn't get on the score sheet, but Salah played very well, I thought, in terms of just, you know, even sort of bouncing balls, it being windy, just causing a bit of chaos. Pretty encouraging going to Munich for that Bayern game where, right, you know, they obviously didn't score in the first leg. And there's been all that kind of talk of, you know, goalless games in four before this one. So, yeah, positives.
Good to get some goals.
Sorry, just to go back to Lallana. I mean, he was one of the first players who seemed to really get what Klopp wanted from Liverpool's players when he arrived in, when was it, October 2015. And he was a really important player that first season. I thought he was the first player who really showed what could be achieved with players sort of being introduced to Klopp's methods. And as Michael was saying, because of injury and various other things, he's now drifted out of the team. And it's been interesting in recent weeks with all these draws that Liverpool have been having. The question always seems to be about, oh, why don't they play Shaqiri? Why don't they bring Shaqiri on? As if Shaqiri is the only backup player capable of giving them something a bit different. And I think what Lallana does well is that, you know, he's generally quite a creative player, but also someone very industrious and with like incredible stamina, like incredible pair of lungs on him. So I wonder whether we might start seeing a bit more of him now that he's shown that he can be effective in those two ways.
Mm. Powerful card to deploy.
Indeed.
In the eight remaining games in this incredibly tight title race. Burnley, only 2 points off the drop now, have Chelsea, City, Man City, that is, and Arsenal in their final four games of the season. So worrying times, these, for the Clarets. 1 point anyway between the top two. What about in Europe? Spurs and Man United are already through to the Champions League quarterfinals. Can Liverpool and City join them? We're going to discuss that with Raphael Honigstein after this.
Hello, James.
Hey, you're crystal clear.
Hold on, I'm just putting my... Yeah, no, it's good.
Mm. Putting your what?
Yeah. What are you putting on, Raph?
I'm putting something in rather than on.
Oh, no, that sounds much worse. Could you take it back out again?
It does?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, hold on. Hold on.
All right, listener. Just seconds away now from hearing what Raphael Honigstein's going to say.
Hello.
Hey, Raphael Honigstein. It's a big week, Rafa. A big week for Premier League, Bundesliga clashes in the Champions League.
It certainly is, James.
Mm. City, as you'll be aware, are home to Schalke, who they beat 3-2 in Gelsenkirchen. A scoreline much tighter than many people anticipated. Liverpool, meanwhile, are off in freezing Munich after that terrible 0-0 with Bayern at Anfield. Now, Bayern Munich, Rafa, fresh from a 6-0 victory over Wolfsburg at the weekend. What's happened? They've really clicked.
The draw and the manner of the draw at Anfield was seen as a bit of a turning point in Munich, because for once the team played collectively, they defended with a sense of sort of cohesion and togetherness. And while they didn't offer a lot going forward, I think everyone came away with a feeling that this is now sort of the moment where maybe things kind of come together as far as the coach and his relationship with the team and the dressing room and the relationship of the players with each other is concerned. So it might not have been the most emphatic spectacle, but they did what they wanted to do. They got what they came for. And I think it was really the stepping stone to the sort of performances that you talked about, the 6-0 against Wolfsburg, but also the 5-1 against Gladbach the week before. Bayern kind of finding a sense of rhythm and purpose again, which had been missing, I think, in recent months.
All right, so a very different approach in this second leg to that shotless performance in the first one.
I'm not sure if the approach is going to be all that different, because Bayern would be very wary of Liverpool's counter-attacking prowess. An away goal for Liverpool would really tilt the balance of the tie, with a score draw being enough for Liverpool to go through. So I think it could be fairly cagey. Of course, Bayern have to score. They have to offer a little bit more than they did at Anfield, which is next to nothing. But I don't think they'll go for out-and-out attack, because Liverpool would just be waiting for that. And we've seen, especially in Europe in the past, that Liverpool enjoy it most when they have one of sort of the bigger, more attacking teams really going at them. That's when they come into their own.
How big is the fact that it's against Jurgen Klopp?
It's not really a factor as far as the team and the club is concerned, but I think it's something that excites the whole of Germany. It is seen as a high-profile game because of Klopp. A lot of people follow Klopp's fortunes. A lot of people always look out for Liverpool's results. And it makes the tie a lot bigger. But there's sort of no real open account, as we say in German. No real unsettled issue as far as his relationship with Bayern is concerned. He himself has always been fairly diplomatic towards Bayern as a team. And the big sort of fights and the big debates and arguments were always between the Bayern officials rather than Bayern and him, or the players and him.
Okay. Well, you can read more about Jurgen Klopp's past and his relationships with Bayern Munich, of course, in the excellent Feel the Noise biography of the German tactical mastermind, written,
sure,
of course.
You can, but my book's called Bring the Noise.
Oh, do you know, I've written that. That's the Slade. That's the Slade reference you should have had. Bring the Noise by our friend Raphael Honigstein. Yep. Rafa, how confident are you for Bayern?
Look, before the first leg, I made Liverpool's favourites. I think now Bayern, with that decent result, have put it back to 50-50, but it's no more than that.
Okay.
And I think we need to get a little bit lucky. We're in the first leg. It's been forgotten. Mane missed at least one sitter, and they need to offer a lot more going forward.
I see. What about City and their clash with Schalke? What kind of percentages are we looking at there?
I'd make it 100% City to go through. Okay, maybe 99, maybe 98, but things are so bad at Schalke that a 4-2 defeat at Werder Bremen was actually seen as a sign of progress. For once, they scored a couple of goals. For once, they looked half decent on the ball, but they still conceded 4 goals, and they're still staring at relegation fight into the face. I mean, they probably won't get relegated, but they're certainly far away from their form of last season when they finished runners-up. So it's really the sort of game I think they can do without. Yes, they can almost play with a sense of freedom, and there is not much riding on that for them. But I think City would have to go to extraordinary lengths of self-destructive effort to get anywhere near being in trouble against against Schalke on Tuesday night.
It's going to be cold in Munich. Wind blowing, snow snowing, all that thing. Tom, what do you think is going to happen in the big Bayern-Liverpool clash?
I think the fact that Bayern have come into a bit of form augurs well for an interesting match. My suspicion is that Liverpool, with the threat they carry on the counter-attack and with Firmino and Mane being in the goals at the weekend and Salah contributing, even if he's not scoring at the moment, I think that should give them enough to go through.
Right. That 6-0 win over Wolfsburg, putting Bayern Munich top on goal difference ahead of Dortmund at the weekend. James, what do you think the midweek holds for them?
Well, Bayern seem to be coming good at exactly the right time. But I think that first leg result does them no favours, just because I think they will, as the ref has said, have to offer a little more, and I think that'll work in Liverpool's favour as well. So I just think the attacking prowess, you don't want to be playing a game where away goals are going to count so much, and Liverpool, you know, one of the major threats in that regard. So I can see Liverpool progressing, which, you know, I think is a little bit of a surprise, given the state that they've been in recently.
Michael, yay, nay?
I agree with Rafa, 50-50.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at royattheroversofficial.com.
Also coming up this week, you've got Barcelona taking on Lyon and Juventus against Atletico Madrid. Now, the Barcelona-Lyon, that was also goalless in the first leg. So away goals counting double for Lyon. Could they do one of their special European games, Tom?
I mean, that's what's required from them. And I think given the extent to which they were dominated in the first leg, 0-0 was a really good result for them. We've seen how dangerous they can be on the counter-attack, particularly against City in the group phase. And so, yeah, I'm guessing that the plan will be to get men behind the ball, to use the pace of Maxwell Cornet, of Bertrand Traoré on the flanks. There's a suggestion in L'Equipe today that Memphis Depay might start up front instead of Moussa Dembele. And Dembele's been in brilliant form of late, scoring very regularly. Not that great at holding the ball up, and Lyon will need an outlet when they do get the ball. So that's why Depay might get the nod. Nabil Fekir is back from suspension, another player who is absolutely instrumental to the way that Lyon play in terms of, you know, giving them a foothold in the opposition half. And the only sort of worry for Lyon is the fitness of Marcelo, their Brazilian centre-back, who's sort of the boss of their defence. Picked up a thigh injury, I think, against Strasbourg at the weekend, so they're sweating over him a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it'll be back to the wall, but I think from what Lyon showed in the group phase, they do have the ability to trouble the big teams when they play on the counter-attack.
Wow, sounds like it's going to be a really tasty game. As we saw last week, one of the Spanish behemoths go crashing out in a major Champions League surprise. I wonder if we could see a second this time.
It would be an incredible result for Lyon. Clearly, Barcelona start as overwhelming favourites.
Just like they did in Rome.
Well, indeed. But I think the fact that this tie is much more obviously in the balance than the tie against Roma appeared to be, given Barcelona's lead. And, you know, they will have learnt their lesson from that. So they'll know, Barcelona, that they need to be on it. So, yeah, you know, you'd back them to go through. But Lyon can hang in there. Who knows?
That game is on Wednesday, so we're going to have a bit of a choice. Watch that or the Bayern-Liverpool game. On Tuesday, you've got Man City-Schalke or Juve's attempts to come from two goals down at home to Atletico Madrid. Am I dreaming, or did they produce a bizarre video inviting...
They did, with a Scottish guy and an English guy walking around the streets of Turin.
Yeah.
Where it was kind of like yin and yang, one saying, oh, definitely not going to come back from this, the other basically saying, yes, they will come back from this, and then arriving at the stadium convinced that Juventus will come back.
Why would you do that?
I have no idea.
Who was the yin and who was the yang out of the Scottish and English guys?
Like, the Scottish guy was the negative one.
Yeah.
So
corresponding with this
nailed that.
Seriously, anyway. So, but beyond that, I don't know, did they get into tactical reasons why it might or might not happen?
In the video?
Yeah.
No, it's pure on instinct and sort of passion.
All right.
You know, okay. And the more the proximity that you have to this event and the, right. the stadium, they just persuaded the Scotsman.
What
that
do you
it's
think?
Who,
which are you with the Scots guy or the English guy? Do you think it's going to happen? Could happen.
I think it definitely could happen. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Allegri after the first leg asked for a silver lining, said, "Well, it's only 2-0. We're lucky because it could have been 3 or 4." He didn't think that they could play as bad as they did in the second half at the Metropolitano. We've seen Juventus the last couple of years go away to Bayern Munich and almost pull off an incredible kind of performance there.
Go away to Real Madrid and almost pull
exactly.
off.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is that should make it a great game.
Yeah.
And also Atleti, Diego Costa suspended, Felipe Luis and Lucas Hernandez, I think, are out injured. Mm. Thomas Partey is also suspended as well. So they've got, you know, a few issues themselves. Juve without suspended Alexandro. And look, they were able to rest a lot of their best players on Friday, had an extra game to rest, recuperate, prepare for this game. But, you know, a lot of focus is going to be on Cristiano Ronaldo right. because so far his Champions League campaign has been pretty underwhelming.
1 goal in 6 and a red card. Whereas, of course, this has always been the competition in which he's been the
top scorer in the last
top
6 years.
The ultimate performer. Do you think he's finally going to turn it on in this, what could be the last chance this season?
Look, I think he has to, because even though he's signed a 4-year contract, there is that sense that this guy is 34 years old. Even being the professional that he is, how he looks after his body, you know, you know, time is not on his side. It's not on a lot of the other veterans at Juventus' side. You know, you think of Giorgio Chiellini and Leonardo Bonucci as well. So, yeah, even though Allegri after Friday's game was saying, look, if we go out, it's not failure, because Atletico Madrid are a very good side and, you know, we're always there or thereabouts every year that I've been here, a lot of people will look at it that way because that's very much what signing Cristiano Ronaldo was all about. It wasn't to win an 8th consecutive league title. It was to end this 23-year wait for the Champions League. And when you look at the teams that have gone out last week, again, there was this sense of this is a great opportunity.
Is Zidane going to Juventus, James?
Well, you know what? This is quite an interesting reaction from the first leg defeat to Atletico Madrid is that Juventus need to be more like Real Madrid, just as Real Madrid are declining and in disgrace. So appoint Zinedine Zidane, sign Marcelo, Isco.
So the Marcelo signing, some people are saying is already done or that terms have already been agreed. But the Zidane story, there's something to that, isn't there? More than the Pep to Juve story.
Oh, yeah, which, you know, Pep said he felt sorry for Max Allegri at the weekend for having to put up with these kind of social media rumours. I don't know, I mean, Allegri met with Agnelli in midweek and said that they're going to talk about an extension in the summer. So not about his future, but an extension, which, yeah, it kind of is the same thing, but slightly nuanced in a different way. Yeah, look, Zidane's still available. There is this sense that...
He's a Juve legend.
Yeah, there is this sense that Allegri is a little bit jaded by some of the coverage that his Juventus team gets, which is, oh, Napoli play better football than you. Oh, your season's going to be a failure because you haven't won the Champions League. And that wears. But I think Allegri, a little bit like Poch, a little bit like Simeone, is someone who doesn't believe in this 3-year rule, you know, that you have to move on because things start to go stale. You know, he's, you know, at Milan, he would have stayed there until he got the sack because Silvio Berlusconi thought he didn't know a thing about football, even though he was the last person to win the league title with them and basically kept things together whilst they were clearly in decline. So, yeah, I think people are more convinced than before that Allegri might be leaving. I'm still deciding he might stay.
Okay. So enough of that sort of thing. We'll get back to the Premier League after this.
People of Liverpool and Leeds, the Totally Football Show is coming your way for 2 live events this March and April. Join Jimbo, Rory Smith from the New York Times, Opta's Duncan Alexander and your very own Russian scouser Sasha Gurionov at Liverpool's Epstein Theatre on Monday, March the 25th. Jimbo and Rory will then be back on Monday, April the 15th at the Leeds City Varieties Music Hall along with Julian Laurent and real-life Yorkshireman James Horncastle. There'll be puns, there'll be punditry, there'll be stories we just can't broadcast on the regular podcast, and the best question of the night will win something amazing, like a signed book or a shaving kit. Yes! So don't miss out. Get your tickets at epsteinliverpool.co.uk for Totally Live in Liverpool on Monday the 25th of March and cityvarieties.co.uk for Totally Live in Leeds on Monday the 15th of April. And keep checking our social media feeds for more information.
Hey, that top four race looking very interesting, isn't it? Spurs losing, Chelsea drawing, and then Arsenal on Sunday in the big game, beating Man United. Matt Limerick says, when you talk about the Arsenal victory over Man United, can you start off with boom shaka laka? That's good work, isn't it, Michael? Because Lacazette?
Yeah, it's not the first time I've heard it.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
All
right.
And also, Lacazette didn't score, so...
No, but he's,
boom,
shaka, he won the penalty.
True. And set up Shaka for the goal. Two assists.
Did he?
Yeah.
It was actually
Laka Xhaka Laka Aubameyang.
Which is better.
Which
to
is
be
even
fair.
Better.
All right. Emery surprised us and United with that lineup.
He did, yeah. And I think he has to be commended for being so bold. You know, Ramsey and Xhaka in centre mid, Ozil at number 10, and then the two strikers up front. But I'm not sure you can go so far as to call it a tactical masterclass. I thought United were unfortunate in many ways in that they created a lot of chances, hit the woodwork twice in the first half. Lukaku should have scored the chance that he put against the crossbar from that Luke Shaw cross. I think Solskjaer perhaps got things wrong with his lineup, the 4-4-2, with Pogba stuck out on the left, which right from the get-go didn't really feel like it was going to work. And then when they changed their shape, they sort of got back into it a bit more. And because it was United's first defeat in the league under Solskjaer, you're sort of looking for underlying reasons for it. But I think United were quite unfortunate and generally played quite well.
As much as they were fortunate when they had that famous win when De Gea saved their
game, so maybe this was, you know, karma coming.
And, they were flummoxed by Xhaka's swaztastic opener.
Yeah, I mean, Solskjaer afterwards said, I could be forgiven for thinking he's Brazilian rather than Swiss for the kind of swaz that he put on that, because, you know, it was, you can see David De Gea just didn't know, you know, what to do with it.
And none of us, I'm thinking, have been top-level goalkeepers, so it's hard for us to evaluate, but there were some harsh words for De Gea. It was surprising to see him so utterly stranded by a ball coming from so far away, but there was considerable movement on that ball.
There was. I think he probably read slightly too much into the way he thought Xhaka was going to strike it. And it did move away from him. I mean, I think it's probably the most difficult type of swerve to deal with if you're a goalkeeper. I mean, Gary Neville in commentary said that it only moved about a yard, but it's not that it moves only a yard. It's the fact it was going one way and it went to the other side, and it's difficult to change direction. Yeah, I agree with what Tom said. And I've been a little bit perplexed by the idea that Arsenal got this tactically spot on. Manchester United created the better chance at 0-0, the better chances when they're 1-0 down, maybe at 2-0 down. I think Arsenal were relatively comfortable. But yeah, I thought Manchester United played well. They hit the woodwork twice. Lukaku missed a really good chance in the, I think, fifth minute. And that came from a Luke Shaw cross. And the problem with playing a 3-4-1-2, as Arsenal did, is you don't have anyone to shut down the fullbacks. And that area of weakness was what created Manchester United's best chance. I thought Rashford and Lukaku linked really, really well. And Arsenal really saved by probably the best performance so far from Bernd Leno, who made two excellent stops from Lukaku, one with his foot. But the one where Lukaku kind of went round him and Leno just scrambled back to make a block, I thought was probably even more impressive.
Really? I thought that was a poor touch, wasn't it, from Lukaku?
I think Lukaku could have taken it a little bit better, but I think Leno did well to make him panic.
Right, fair enough. It takes Arsenal's tally, this victory, against their fellow big six teams this season, if you're counting, to 12 points, which is double what they managed in their final year under Arsene Wenger.
Unlucky not to have more, given what happened in the North London derby as well, with Aubameyang missing the penalty, which he didn't miss this time around.
Right, with that incredible, I'm not looking at the ball, penalty-taking technique. And that must take astonishing bravery.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Was it Nathan Ellington who played up front for Wigan at some point? And he was a very prolific... The Duke, as he was known. He was quite a prolific penalty scorer.
Right.
And that was his thing, not looking at the ball. And it's... When you actually look at it and you saw the replay of Aubameyang just fixing his eyes on the goalkeeper, it looks a bit...
It's freaky.
Strange, a bit freaky. It makes a lot of sense, really. And the most successful penalty takers, I generally think, are the ones who do wait to see which way the goalkeeper moves and then put it in the other corner, because it's basically impossible for the goalkeeper to save then, rather than picking your spot and hoping for the best.
When it works.
When it works.
Yeah, because it wasn't the best hit penalty. I mean, it sort of bobbled in.
Mm. Well, De Gea was fuming as well. You know, when it went in, as if De Gea knew what was coming and he thought he'd moved too early.
Right. Ironic, because he'd moved too late. The curious thing, though, about this Arsenal performance was it came after a midweek that had seen Man United stage the remarkable comeback in Paris and Arsenal themselves losing 3-1 in the Europa League. Obviously, that was after our Thursday show. That Rennes result, what happened there, Tom? And what are their chances of turning that result around this Thursday when they meet again at the Emirates?
I mean, amazing result for Rennes. And I think particularly having gone behind as early as they did, and you've got the stadium is sort of, you know, is full, and you've got all the fans behind the team, and then Arsenal score early on, and there was a period where it looked like Arsenal might take control. But Rennes sort of stuck to their task. Obviously, the sending off of Socrates was a big help. But I think the fact that they kept on attacking till the end to get that third goal and just give themselves that little advantage. Got another win at the weekend, 3-1 against Caen. Also coming from behind to win that. And yeah, you know, they're going to go into that game on Thursday with a huge amount of confidence. Again, expecting that Arsenal will have most of the ball. But they're a really good counter-attacking team, man. I mean, yeah, Ismaïla Sarr scored the third goal against Arsenal, got a couple of assists against Caen. You've got Mbanyang on the other wing. They've got players coming back from suspension. So, I mean, you know, Arsenal winning 2-0 at home to a team of Rennes' standing shouldn't be beyond them. But I think the fact that they got that third goal does give Rennes, you know, a little bit more of an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. There was a bit of a pitch invasion in the Arsenal-Man United game. We'll talk about pitch invasions a little bit later on. We'll also hopefully be hearing from Chris Goulding of the We Are Birmingham website and podcast, getting their take as, you know, the people most directly involved in all this, along with poor old Jack Grealish. Anyway, Chelsea taking on Wolves. That Hazard goal was a bit special. So was the defending until that point. Is that fair? Unlike Chelsea's defending on the Wolves goal.
Yeah, they got torn apart by Jimenez and Hotta, who played not just a 1-2, but I think a 3-4 through the centre of the pitch, which I enjoyed. Yeah, Sarri was incredibly dismissive of Wolves after the game. I thought that was bizarre.
That was really, really unpleasant, actually.
Said to anyone who didn't hear this, the interviewer said, well, Wolves were very organised against you. And he said, no, there's no need for organisation when you defend that deep with such a low block, which isn't true, is it? You do need to be organised.
And he was explaining his tactical change to go to 4-2-3-1, and he basically said yes, because Wolves just, you know, they didn't want to counter, they didn't want to do anything. So, yeah. But I thought that Hotta Jimenez partnership, I mean, I think they've been involved, they've combined for all of Wolves' last three goals. And as Michael said, if you look at the goals they've been involved in, it's always them two just passing it together. They just seem to have this kind of kinetic kind of ESP, yeah. They just seem to be on the same wavelength. And just, it's great strike play, as we'll later talk about with Ayoze Perez and Solomon Rondon
right,
as well.
Right, yeah, that big Newcastle win.
Yeah.
Woof, what a victory that was. Lots of people getting very excited about Connor Cody and talking up his chances of breaking into Gareth Southgate's England team. What about what Spurs got up to down at St Mary's? Massive result this for both the top four race and, of course, the battle to avoid the bottom three. Spurs were looking good after Harry Kane scored his usual goal, his 200th, actually, of his career.
Lovely ball from Dele Alli as well. He's back in the team. Not expected to start in that game, but, yeah, Spurs played very well in the first half. Should have killed the game. Didn't, and were made to pay for it by some proactive management from Hasenhüttl in the changes that he made. Again, one of the sort of stories of the weekend, that he brings on Josh Sims, who had been on loan at Reading, and I think he only made 5 starts for Reading so far this season, so he wasn't coming back to the Southampton side because he'd been doing so well at Reading that they thought, right, we've got to have this guy, and comes in and helps them, you know, really change the game, put Spurs on the back foot. Spurs got complacent in the second half and also missed some pretty big chances. You think that one where Eriksen again puts the ball in for Kane, and Kane has all the time and space in the world and thinks he doesn't, and, yeah, blazes it wide. You know, ultimately, yeah, really disappointing away performance again from Spurs in the Premier League.
Right. Was it the Valerie goal that it whizzes past three?
Yeah.
Three players.
Danny Rose basically steps over it, not realising there's someone coming in behind.
Well, I guess the first two are thinking, I don't want to touch this and put it into my own net. But that was extraordinary. And then, as was the moment when James Ward-Prowse steps over the free kick, and you think, he couldn't, could he? And he certainly could.
Yeah, I think of all the players in the Premier League, if if in football you could use a dead ball specialist like in American football to just bring someone on to take set pieces, I think he'd be the leading candidate because he is outstanding. He's got a kind of David Beckham-esque technique, as he's shown two games in a row, almost identical free kicks. But in open play, I'm never quite sure what his position is. He's kind of a right centre midfielder. I don't think he really belongs in either position. But Pep Guardiola said a couple of months into the campaign he's the best set piece taker in England, and he's shown that in recent weeks.
Mm. Lovely whippage.
Mm.
Seems nice. To get a lot of whip on the ball.
He also did the Ronaldo kind of celebration.
Yeah, what was that about?
Yeah.
Well, he did a bit too. He did like the Ronaldo celebration where he jumps in the air, puts his arms to the ground, and goes, "Sew!" And then he did. You know, he had his tongue out, which is very Del Piero kind of.
Oh, interesting.
Both, well, one very good free kick taker in Del Piero, one less good in Cristiano Ronaldo.
Right. So. Fair. So that leaves Saints still 2 points from the drop because Cardiff won. Spurs, meanwhile, their top four hopes. Tom, are they on the rocks now?
Yeah, they are. I mean, absolutely disastrous run of form, a fairly complete loss of momentum in the league, at least. But you look, I mean, I think an interesting element here is the fact that Chelsea, who are in sixth, have a game in hand. Mm. They're currently 4 points off Spurs, but if they win that game in hand, they'd be a point behind them. So you then have Spurs, Arsenal, Chelsea and United separated by 3 points.
Right.
So yeah, I think if I was a Spurs fan, I would be worried.
And Spurs were 13 points clear of Man United when Mourinho left. So obviously they've been doing a lot better, but Spurs have, I'm guessing, been doing a lot worse. They've only won two of their last six Premier League games.
And they've been 1-0 up in three of those.
Wow.
And not been able to hold on to it. And it was quite interesting at the weekend where Pochettino obviously was serving a touchline ban and yet insisted on doing the media afterwards, and was very critical of his players' attitude.
It felt like there was a message in those words. I'm not sure if you could decode it for you. He says, maybe this is our limit. It's a little bit sad, but maybe we need to operate in a different way from the start of next season. I think we need more and we are not there. We need to find a way to make the club better. What's he talking about?
Well, I think in terms of his players, he's talking about the mentality for the form that we've just alluded to, for the fact that their second half performance was so different from their first half performance that they can't hold on to leads, at least in the Premier League recently, but also from what the club strategy is, because if they don't make Champions League, then they won't get the revenue that you get from that, and we all know how tightly run that club is, and given that, you know, I agree with Michael, the point that you've made on a few occasions, that having a settled squad and not joining in the rat race of spending for the sake of spending it is a good one, but at the same time, I think, yeah, that will impact Spurs' ability to attract and buy players in the summer if they don't get there. So, yeah, I think there is a little bit of a message. Not the first time that Pochettino's made a kind of sent that kind of message to the
they are
to
still
the people
third,
upstairs.
Though.
They are third. They've got, I think, depending on the draw that they get in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, got a real chance of maybe reaching the semi-finals and being like Roma were last year, Monaco the year before that. They could be that kind of team in the Champions League this season. And yeah, I mean, they've been, even though they've lost their last three away games, I think they've still got the best away record in the Premier League, which is, you know, pretty astonishing, really.
Right. Their next game's away, you know, at Anfield. Yeah. And I say next, it's not for ages because they're not playing in the FA Cup next weekend and they don't have a game because their opponents are. And then the following weekend, it's the international break. And then they come back and do the break could do them the power of good, of course.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Also, when they do return from that and play a home game, it might be at the new ground, Michael.
Yeah, possibly. I think they're going to have a couple of preparation events before then, but it's looking promising, and it'd be nice to see them in the
new
ground.
Stadium.
And it looks, I'm excited to go there. It looks fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, from the pictures you've seen from the inside, it looks great, but I've walked past it as well, and it's just, it's staggeringly large.
It's the size of Wembley, almost. I mean, it's smaller than Wembley, but like it has the similar sort of physical presence, and it's just been dropped into, you know, middle of Tottenham.
Shame there's no cheese room though.
Mm.
Hi, I'm Rodri Giggs. You probably know me for being related to a famous sports star. That's right, my dad did play rugby for Wales. I've always lived a loyal life, always use the same brand of tea bags, I always drink in the same pub,
hey, mate, what are they doing, mate?
And always support my country.
A huge defeat for Wales. Questions will be asked of the manager.
Questions will be asked. You see, loyalty gets you nowhere. Live for rewards instead. That's why I'm Paddy's Rewards Club Ambassador.
Paddy Power's Rewards Club. Loyalty's dead. Live for rewards.
T's and C's apply. 18+. Be gambleaware.org.
on Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere. This is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Fans, wrong-headed fans running on pitches. Three incidents over the last few days. On Friday, a man was arrested after Rangers' James Tavernier was confronted in the game with Hibs. On Sunday, as we mentioned, at the Emirates, a fan running on and giving Chris Smalling a bit of a shove, by the looks of it, before trying to celebrate with the Arsenal fans after their penalty. And worst of all, at St Andrews on Sunday afternoon in the Second City Derby, Jack Grealish hit from behind. Pleasingly, Grealish keeping his cool and later going on to score the winner in a 1-0 victory for Villa, which moves them past Birmingham up to ninth, 4 points off the playoffs. But it was, I think, a scene that shocked many of us, not least the fact that after the fan punched Grealish from behind, Birmingham fans appeared to applaud him off as he was being escorted from the pitch.
Some Birmingham fans.
Some Birmingham fans, because not all Birmingham fans are like that.
No.
And indeed, on that note, let's hear from Chris Goulding of We Are Birmingham website and podcast. Chris, thanks for joining us. You're a long-time season ticket holder at St Andrews. What did you make of what happened on Sunday afternoon?
I've got to be honest, I was in complete shock when it happened. I saw the guy get past security and run onto the pitch, and he went past one Villa player, and instantly you knew where he was going. And it's hard to describe the shock. I know a lot of people, I think they maybe had a few beers and the cheers were out of order. It was just absolutely shocking.
Why Grealish, Chris?
I think there's a bit of history there with him being a Villa fan. Growing up, he gives it out a bit, bigs it up, and like you would do if you were up against your rivals. But then there's also the side to Grealish, which I think a lot of fans around the country don't like, which is his play acting. He's thrown himself on the floor, and that tends to wind people up as well, I think.
Right, OK, but obviously not to the extent that any action like this is justified.
No, of course not. So, there are people condoning it and calling the guy a legend, and I can't understand that, but I think majority of the Blues fan base are very disappointed and feel a bit let down by the guy.
Were you surprised at how many people applauded him as he was being taken off the field?
Yes and no. I think I was in shock at the time. But I think a lot of people, they'd been out on the beer, and as he was taken off, gave it a cheer, much in the same way. I've actually seen mentioned, and I know that was an on the field incident, but when Dion Dublin headbutted Robbie Savage, it was technically assault, but it was during the game of football, and Dion Dublin became a bit of a hero and he was cheered off the pitch. And I think, while not condoning either, that was probably how people saw it. It was like, yeah, go on, do it. Completely not right. And maybe those people will take a look at themselves this morning and think, what was I doing? Why was I cheering? That was completely out of order.
Right. How harsh do you think the penalties are likely to be for Birmingham? A lot of people calling for even points to be deducted from the club.
Personally, I think if what the club have done wrong is they've subcontracted the security out to a firm that just can't handle it. If you come down to St Andrews on a match day, you'll see 16, 17-year-old kids and people who are reaching retirement age and have maybe lost their jobs. And it seems as though they're probably working for minimum wage, can't really be bothered to do much. If you look at the picture of the guy getting escorted off the pitch, there was a young kid and an older guy. They don't really know what they're doing, I don't think. And I think the one issue that Blues have had is that they've taken this security firm that they've subcontracted to. They haven't done their job. And I think that what Blues are guilty of is preventing the fan getting on the pitch, the same as Arsenal. They're guilty of the fan getting on the pitch. And I think that's what Blues should be punished for. What the person's actions are when they get onto the pitch is a completely different offence. You can't say that Blues are guilty of that person's actions. In my eyes, that's the individual, and that's to be dealt with by the courts, and to be punished properly as a criminal act.
Chris Goulding, who was keen to point out that it'd be a shame if the actions of this idiot and the other many idiots who applauded him wiped out all the goodwill that's been done by the great community work that Birmingham and their supporters have been doing, which is a fair point. Also a fair point he made about Dion Dublin hitting poor Robbie Savage.
I'm just watching that.
Can you just talk us through the dynamic? Because I don't remember this incident.
Well, I mean...
Basically, this game is why the games are no longer played in the evenings and instead are played at midday on a Sunday where theoretically people haven't been drinking.
OK, but Dion Dublin presumably wasn't on the source when he headbutted.
No, he wasn't, but there were running battles.
It's an extraordinary thing to watch because basically Dion Dublin is not even in shot. Robbie Savage has got the ball in midfield about to play it forward and someone just comes running from behind him, sides him down, and then obviously they square up to each other and then there's the aforementioned headbutt. It's disgraceful.
There's a great interview with Dion Dublin in the current issue of 442 magazine where he reveals that when he was a youngster at Norwich he used to live with Jason Statham.
I'm sorry?
You have to buy the magazine to find out the full backstory because I can't remember.
Leaving on the cliff edge there, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine them two together on? Is it Holmes Under the Hammer?
Yeah, or equally in one of the many great Jason Statham films. Anyway, what should be done, Michael? Loads of listeners written in with suggestions like points deductions and that. What do you think?
Personally, I think it should be something that punishes the fans rather than the team. So whether that's closing a stand as they do abroad or closing the ground or maybe banning them from travelling to away games for a game. But personally, I prefer it if it's kept to the supporters rather than punishing the on-field performance.
OK, that sounds fair. As long as it sends a message.
Well, I do think you have to
send a message
considering it happened three times. But I think it's worth pointing out. I mean, personally, I think there's been incredible overreaction, people talking about the moral decay of English society based upon these incidents. But top two divisions at the weekend, 610,000 people attended football games. You did have these two bad incidents, but it tends to be a couple of idiots rather than something representative of people overall.
OK, well, a busy weekend in the West Midlands because Darren Moore, after West Brom drew with struggling Ipswich, got that corner flag picture. Actually, it was
stadium
the pitch. Yeah,
aspect.
There was no flag per se, but yeah, West Brom letting him go after a real dip in form. Only one of their last nine league games at the Hawthorns have resulted in Baggies wins, but they are still fourth in the Championship. So a real surprise this, but you know what? The Totally Football League show, they'll have more in the Totally Football League show on Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, like everyone who hasn't seen a single West Brom game this season, I think is a complete disgrace. And everyone who has seen a lot of West Brom games seems to think it's probably a logical decision. So
right,
it probably tells you something.
Right. Somewhere there's a Scotsman and Englishman wandering around West Brom. And yeah. Anyway, all right, one more in the Totally Football League show. After this, we address the relegation battle in the Premier League. Greaves says, please cover in detail Brighton doing the league double over Palace for the first time in 35 years. And this little French magician's involvement. He's talking about Anthony Nockert.
Yep.
Yeah. You're licking your lips just at the mention of his name. That was a great goal.
Yeah, an Iron Robin-esque goal, I think we can say. It was an eventful game for him because, 10 seconds in, he goes in for a 50-50 with Milivojevic.
Right.
And I think he's only half a second late, but really plants his studs into a delicate part of Milivojevic. Yeah. It could have been a red card, to be fair.
Absolutely, absolutely. Instead, he produces the winner in this huge victory for Brighton, who'd been in really desperate form on the road. It's the second win in a row, actually. It takes them up to 15th place. Glenn Murray, who came into the side because... Who was it got injured?
Andone.
And actually proved to be quite a welcome addition to the team because he...
That was a great finish. Like,
yeah,
a really, really difficult finish to do, I think, to take that ball like that. And obviously against his old team in the A23 derby.
Right, as Jonathan Pearce was keen to point out.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the M23 derby. The game match I really wanted to focus on was Newcastle-Everton. Obviously, there were other things that happened. Cardiff had a very important win, beating West Ham 2-0, producing their eighth clean sheet of the season. That's more than United and Arsenal have managed. They don't play for another 3 weeks, and then they have Cardiff, Chelsea at home, City away, Burnley away, and then Liverpool at home. So this really was a much-needed win. Also this weekend, Leicester beat Fulham 3-1, with Tielemans looking great again. Tom, you were there at that game.
I was indeed.
Wasn't particularly going to focus on that unless you... Was there one thing you wanted to draw from that match?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was Brendan Rodgers' first home game, and obviously we're all eager to see what he's going to make of this new job. And he'd set Leicester out in a sort of counter-attacking 3-4-2-1 when they lost at Watford weekend before last. But it was a 4-1-4-1 against Fulham. And with this really sort of pleasing attacking midfield quartet of Harvey Barnes, James Maddison, Youri Tielemans, Demarai Gray playing behind Vardy. And what Leicester did really well was winning the ball up high up the pitch and getting the ball through to Vardy quickly. We know that
Callum
Vardy...
Callum Chambers helped them with that. Really
Callum Chambers well. Did play a significant role in that.
Harvey Barnes, by the way, whose removal from that West Brom side is seen by many who have actually watched a Baggies game as being one of the reasons why their form has suddenly dried up to Darren Moore's expense.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, back to your experience at the King.
Yeah, and you know, basically Vardy's relationship with Claude Puel, or rather lack of relationship with Claude Puel, became quite sort of symbolic of what was going wrong for Leicester. And it's obviously going to be very important for Rodgers to get Vardy on side. And one of the things that he spoke about, Rodgers, after the match was getting players up the pitch around Vardy and getting the ball through to him quickly. And there were two perfect scenarios for Vardy. The first goal, and Didi wins the ball back, plays it through to him, and Vardy ends up squaring it to Tielemans for a tap-in. And then I think it was Vardy's first goal, Maddison wins the ball back and slips it through. So signs of what Rodgers is trying to change at Leicester, and signs that it might be to Jamie Vardy's benefit.
OK. Fulham remain very much in the bottom three.
Fulham were pretty hopeless.
OK. Huddersfield also pretty hopeless, losing at home to a Bournemouth side who I think had lost their previous nine games on the road, but 2-0 winners here. So that means that, Huddersfield and Fulham look gone, bless them. Cardiff are on 28 points, Burnley and Saints on 30 points, and then Palace and Brighton on 33, a little bit further up, with Newcastle on 34 now, after that extraordinary comeback on Saturday against Everton. Rafa Benitez, 3 seasons now, or 3 years, he's been at St James's. That's got to be one of the best days, from 2-0 down to 3-2 winners.
Well, also, when they miss the penalty and see Everton essentially go up the other end and double their lead, I mean, that usually is like a knife through the heart for any team. So to come back from that, I think, was extraordinary. It was the first time that Newcastle had come back from 2 goals down to win since October 2003.
Wow.
I think, when Bobby Robson was still manager.
It's only the second time in 394 games, according to a stat I read on social media, that Everton have been up 2-0 at half-time and lost. Only ever happened once before in all that time. Anyway, and this was an Everton team that looked like it had turned that corner the previous weekend, with the crowd behind them in the Merseyside derby and that spirited performance against
Jordan
Liverpool.
Pickford had the crowd behind him in this game.
So now, okay, how big a role does he play in what happens to Everton?
I think a massive role. I mean, he shouldn't be on the pitch, you know, after, I say, you know, giving away the penalty. Yeah, he makes no attempt to play the ball. It's a rugby tackle. But I mean, he ran off at half time, you know, sticking his tongue out to the Geordie fans. I mean, yeah not good.
It's worth pointing out on the non-sending off, the rules were changed slightly in 2016 in terms of this double jeopardy. If it's a penalty,
right,
then you shouldn't be red card as well. Though in this instance, I don't think he was making any attempt to play the ball. But since that rule change, there hasn't been a single goalkeeper sent off in the Premier League, coming up to 3 years. And cool. It would generally happen 4 or 5 times a season, and now goalkeepers are seemingly immune from it.
Right. Ayuso Perez, bit special.
Yeah, I loved Rafa Benitez's take on the, was it the Rondon goal, where he says that goal, you could imagine Lionel Messi doing what Ayuso Perez did with the pass, and you can imagine Alan Shearer finishing like Salomon Rondon did.
Wow,
imagine that. Imagine that.
Woof.
It is amazing, though, because when Perez sort of brings it down, he does what you expect Rondon usually does, you know, in terms of sort of good target man play. And just like Jimenez and Hotter, you know, it's just great partnership. Really.
And Deeney and De La Feu when they came on.
Yeah,
and I thought Arsenal Man United, we had two Sides playing two up front, combining well. It was a bit of a throwback weekend in that respect.
Nice, nice. Right, anyway, so Newcastle are moving themselves away from trouble. The bad news this weekend for the Magpies is the fact that Sean Longstaff is going to be out for the rest of the season with a knee ligament injury. That's an awful shame.
Also, James, I mean, not to labour the point on VAR, but Newcastle's winner should have been ruled out for offside. They're about five players offside.
Oh, yeah, there was that.
So, I mean, when you're in a relegation battle like this, you know, imagine if they stay up by, I don't know, a single point or something like that. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
It's pretty galling if you're
but
going
that's
down.
Football.
That is sport.
That's
football, James.
That's sport. You can't post-mortem everything while the patient's still alive because you kill it.
Yeah.
That's the metaphor I'm going to work on before I mention it again. Anyway, all right. Let's talk about Claudio Ranieri. Woohoo! After this. Last Thursday, Claudio Ranieri returning from the wilderness to the world of top-flight football management, taking over the helm of Roma, returning to the club where he'd delighted fans almost a decade ago, actually, with the Giallorossi, when he very nearly, for half an hour, was about to snatch the title from Jose Mourinho's Inter.
Which and stopped them doing the treble.
Yeah.
And he came very close to doing it as well.
I mean, as he himself talked about this weekend, they were winning against Chievo, Inter were drawing at Siena, and I think it was Zlatan, wasn't it, got that late winner that day. Wasn't it Zlatan?
No. That was a couple of seasons beforehand.
Oh, okay.
That was it against Parma in the rain. But no, I mean, the game that changed that title race was Roma losing at home to Samp.
Yeah.
Philippe Mexès crying on the bench. And I thought it was interesting that Ranieri, after getting the Roma job for a second time, said that not even winning the Premier League with Leicester essentially could help him get over losing that title with Roma.
Because this is his club.
It's his club.
Romano Verace.
And a lot of people on social media like saying, well, you know, why has Ranieri got this job? You know, he's landed on, as you said, failing upwards. But the reality is this is an interim appointment. They contacted him and he basically said, I will do this because I love the club. It doesn't matter how much you pay me. Doesn't matter if I don't get the job on a permanent basis at the end of the season. I just want to help out my team. Yeah, that's what he's gone there to do. He's got a big job on his hands because of the injury crisis that there is at Roma. But yeah, you know, I think it's really important at Roma, more than many other clubs, for someone to be so the manager to understand the environment that there is around the club, the atmosphere, the fan base, what it's like to work in that city. It's very peculiar compared with other clubs.
Michael, you're a big fan of what he did last time he was there.
Yeah, they were just such a good team to watch. You know, there was so much hype around the era before under Spalletti and the kind of false nine, but I thought Ranieri kind of perfected that. You know, Totti played the same role, but with Vucinic running in behind, they were brilliant. And that Samp game, I mean, I'm not a Roma fan, but I think if I could reverse one result in the last 10 years of football,
you'd choose that one.
Yeah, really? I just love that Roma team. It was such a great story. And
if you could reverse one result in the last 10 years,
yeah, honestly,
that's an interesting question. They
were brilliant.
Dimmi cose.
We'll come back to you on this later on.
Wales losing.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Yeah, Wales losing to Portugal in Euro 2016 semi-final.
Right, OK. Yeah. We'll get yours in a second then James. Anyway, so, happy days and what a team. Roma have Empoli this Monday evening. Mm-hmm. And it's a big game because they're 6 points off the top four with this game in hand. They've now got Torino and Atalanta level with them on points. And anyway, there was a big clear-out last Thursday in Roma after they went out of the Champions League against Porto. Di Francesco, the previous manager, let go by the club. And also Monchi, the transfer guru, whose trades hadn't really worked out too well. But I guess if you let the likes of Alisson go, then this is going to be slightly the result. He's off as well. Is he going to go to Arsenal?
I think there's quite a high chance that he will go to Arsenal. I think it's
would that be good for Arsenal? Work wonders, of course, at Sevilla. He was famed for his ability to produce gold from base metals there.
With Emery there as well.
With Emery, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, what was strange about his time at Rome, I suppose, is that he tied his future to Di Francesco's, which that's not what you appoint a sporting director for. Sporting director is there to provide continuity of the project, regardless of who the manager is. You are there to defend the interests of the club, not the manager, because all managers are temporary. You know, I think in terms of his track record, you want to look at the the signings that he made, okay, he made Roma a 69 million profit over 2 years or something like that. You could say that the depth that he gave the squad helped them reach the semi-finals of the Champions League last year, but a lot of the players that he sold were bought by his predecessor, Walter Sabatini. You know, in terms of the sort of good signings that he's made, Kolarov's been unexpectedly very good. Zaniolo obviously has attracted a lot of attention. Cengiz Under. But then you give a 5-year contract to Javier Pastore, who's got no place in the team and is, you know, I think the highest paid player at the club after De Rossi. I think, yeah, you can't really judge a sporting director's work over one or two windows. I think you have to see how it progresses over a longer period. And he obviously hasn't got that and thinks he'll be proved right over time. But
I'm skeptical about whether these transfer gurus, whether their skills are necessarily as transferable between clubs as managers or players. There's just such a big structure between you and getting the players. And then even if you sign good players, you're dependent on the manager or dependent upon outside circumstances. So it just seems that one or two transfers that go well and these guys get reputations as fantastic. Whereas, you know, we've seen Sven Mislintat at Arsenal didn't go well. So I have to see if Munchie does better at Arsenal if he goes there.
Fair enough. All right, then. Well, let's get some odds now on some of these football matters. Producer Ben has been speaking to Paddy Power.
Thank you, Jimbo. Lee Price from Paddy Power is on the line as always. And Lee, what a weekend that was and what a midweek we have to look forward to. Let's start, though, with the Premier League. The race for third and fourth is really hotting up. What are the numbers telling you?
Oh, it's wide open, isn't it? And this has swung away from Man United worse than the Granit Xhaka shot. Not so long ago, they looked rock solid in the chase for top four. But now they're more likely to finish sixth, according to our odds. And our betting also says Tottenham should finish third, despite everything. They're 8-15 for a top four spot. It's Arsenal we expect to see finish fourth. They're 8-11 to secure Champions League qualification through the league. Chelsea are even to get back into top four. Man United 7-5.
On to the Champions League then, Lee. We've heard from Rafa Honigstein already today, but tell us what the markets are saying for Liverpool versus Bayern Munich.
Well, as we heard earlier in the show, Bayern Munich have rediscovered their mojo in recent weeks, so it's perhaps no surprise that we favour the Germans here. They're evens to win the match, Liverpool 12-5, either team on penalties is 20-1. As a first goal scorer, we mentioned Bayern's form. They've scored 11 goals in the last two league games, four of those Lewandowski. He's 3-1 to score first. Or, if you fancy the Reds, you can get 11-2 on Mo Salah opening and scoring, 7-1 Sadio Mane, or 17-2, a big price for Bobby Firmino.
Barcelona and Juve were kept goalless in their first legs against Lyon and Atletico Madrid. So give us the numbers, please, on both of them going out this week.
Yeah, it certainly continued the trend of last week, wouldn't it? And we fully expect Juve to get knocked out. It's 2-9 that Atletico qualify, that two-goal cushion looking very comfortable. But we're even more confident about Barcelona's progress. They're 1-6 to qualify and 1-5 to see off Lyon within 90 minutes. If you do have a French fancy, Ben, it's 7-2 that Lyon go through. So put that shock double together and it's 4.5-1 that both Barcelona and Juventus go out. Unthinkable, surely.
Right. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. While all that was going on, James, what have you been doing?
I don't think I've ever seen this before, James, but Sergio Ramos is interviewing himself. He's asking himself questions on Twitter, such as, why did you record the documentary? And this is all in English. There are certain commitments made and it never remotely went through my head that the game could have turned out as it did. The recording itself was scaled down as the game went on.
Does he answer a question about when you picked up that deliberate yellow card?
He does. Yeah, he does.
What does he say?
Was the yellow card in Amsterdam an error? Absolutely it was an error, and I take the blame 200%.
Okay.
He also, you know, takes these questions, yeah, very direct questions posed by himself to, you know, did you argue with the president in the dressing room? Dressing room issues are discussed and resolved in the dressing room. There's no problem whatsoever. And everybody has the same interest at Real Madrid.
Right. Well, if he could reverse any fixture in the last 10 years, I think I can guess which one it would be. But James, we never got your answer.
I concur with Michael.
Oh, really? You can't have the same one, though. That's not the rules of the game.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Would it be, Real Madrid Juve from last season?
No.
Buffon? For Gigi? Do it for Gigi.
Something for Gigi then. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So, yeah, Cardiff. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you'd keep Mandzukic's goal, though, from the Cardiff final, even if you were to change things.
The thing is, it's not just... it's reversing it. It's not reversing the scoreline. It's saying you can play again. With the Juve's finals, I don't really have the impression that letting them play again would make any difference. You know what I mean?
Fair. Yeah.
But anyway, have a ponder on that, because I'm sure we're going to return to this question. Okay. It's a great question. What have you got this week, Tom?
Lots of watching Champions League, which I'm looking forward to, as ever.
Yeah, me too. Especially after that build-up to the Barcelona-Lyon. Absolutely. All right, well, once all the Champions League football's done, we'll return on Thursday. Daniel Story, Julien Laurens and Jack Lang will be in the hot seats. Oh, hello, Tom.
Can I just mention, I mentioned them when I was in on Thursday, Colwyn Bay.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right.
Handed the shareholder vote about whether to remain in the English league system or return to the Welsh system.
Right.
They voted to go back to Wales. And today they have...
Coxed.
They have...
No, that doesn't work.
What did you say?
I was trying to... Anyway, I was trying to give it a fashionable kind of term, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, sort of. And today they've started the process of formally applying to join the Welsh system as of next season. And when they announced that they were going to have this vote, they released a slightly clumsily worded statement in which they said that whereas their hearts wanted to remain in England, their heads said that returning to Wales was the only way forward.
Really?
Which has not been to the taste of the fans of the various Welsh clubs they'll be playing against from next season. So while there may be a welcome in the hillsides for Colwyn Bay, it may not be a warm one.
How will they overcome the backstop?
I mean, this is all to be discussed. I'm sure the chairman's got a plan. How hard can it be sorting out something like that?
Right.
Easiest deal in history. Be a Donald.
Excellent. Listener, we're back on Thursday. Look forward to speaking to you then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. And don't forget to check out our other football podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts, and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really. And here at The Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK. So that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5 p.m. till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.